wondering what we're going to see come July. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
It's good to be back with you, Barry. It's we're giving the ladies and gentlemen of the audience a nice fresh show because, again, we're recording late in the week, so it won't be very old. Our analysis will be fairly new by the time they hear this, and we're glad to do it that way.
Yeah, that's true. Now, you know, I mentioned July in our teaser opening, and it isn't just because, Chuck, that here we are in March, right before spring, and we've got snow falling again. Welcome to Ohio, folks. Wait 5 minutes, the weather will change. But, you know, it's because July is when a lot of things that everybody is talking about right now and everyone is presuming or anticipating, maybe with hope or with dread, is going to come to fruition, because July is when the Republican Party, yes, that dysfunctional Leviathan that's out there right now flailing and floundering about, is going to go to their national convention, Chuck. And then we're going to find out for sure if we're going to be dealing with a brokered convention, if we're going to be dealing with the split of the party and a rise of an independent candidacy by the Donald, if we're going to see, backroom dealings happen where you end up with, like, crazy combinations, which, you know, actually, if you think about it, Chuck, back during the 1980 Republican convention, the reason why we had George Bush Sr. as president in 1988 was because of backroom dealings to send his delegates to support Ronald Reagan. So we've got all of these things going on, so who knows what could happen. But in the middle of July, in Cleveland, of all places, we're going to be finding out for certain what is happening there. Now, the question remains here is, you know, can the Donald garner enough support in winner-take-all states to get to the magical number? I think it's 1,237 delegates pledged to him in order to take the nomination without there being a contested floor vote. Or will, the remaining trio of hangers-on, that being Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and John Kasich, are they going to be able to amass enough support? You know, will Rubio win his own home state of Florida on the 15th of March? Will John Kasich win Ohio in March? You know, you and I have talked about that, and I think the answer to both those questions is a resounding no.
No.
But should they happen to do that, then we may be looking at a completely different scenario coming into July. We could be looking at a brokering or a coalescing, I should say, of support, and you might see a Rubio-Kasich ticket, or you might see a Cruz-Rubio ticket, or, you know, you could actually see something even wilder than that, because, Chuck, you know, we're recording this on the day before it airs on Friday, but just yesterday on Thursday, three significant things happened. The first significant thing was the return of Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, who the establishment hung their entire star upon in the 2012 election, only to understand that when he said 47%, he was being optimistic as about how much support he would get in the presidential election.
Yes.
Who then came out yesterday blistering Donald Trump and making all kinds of claims. And then you had Donald Trump, who turned around and had his own, he was having a rally, and he spent the first 15 minutes or so of it responding to the Mitt Romney press conference and bringing up to the point of people that Mitt Romney sought and coveted Donald Trump's endorsement in that 2012 race, even appearing with the Donald in his hotel in Las Vegas to accept his endorsement, and talked about how wonderful businessman and how great he was for the country. Funny how things change when it's your ox getting gored, Chuck.
Well, Barry, I had to laugh. I saw a headline, and I'm trying to dig it up so we can put it on the website. But it was, "Knowing what I know now, I would not have accepted Donald's endorsement.
Okay, well, then that means that, Mitt, you really weren't ready for prime time, because usually folks on a serious presidential campaign, you have people who do research and who vet everything around people who want to support you publicly in order not to be embarrassed when something comes up in their past. You know, you don't want like somebody endorsing you because you, you know, great family values, only to find out that maybe they're running an illicit pornography ring. You know, those are the kind of things you don't want to have happen in your campaign, because, you know, obviously those things can wreck a presidential campaign, unless, of course, you're Donald Trump, who, it doesn't seem much of anything can wreck this campaign right now, because Trump's supporters seem to not only excuse things that otherwise they would find abhorrent in a candidate, flip-flopping, you know, out and out, possibly lying to them on positions that they hold, telling one group one thing and another group something completely 180 degrees opposite. But yet it seems that many supporters of Donald Trump are looking past all those things, because there's a grander purpose involved here, Chuck. And that grander purpose, I think, having talked to only a small handful of Trump supporters and obviously seeing the chatter that's out on social media around this, honestly, I think really, and I'm not going to say the vast majority, but I think at least a segment of Donald Trump supporters are people who are just fed up with the Republican Party as a whole, and this is their gotcha moment for the Republican Party. This is the chickens coming home to roost campaign.
Oh, absolutely.
This is, we're going to see how loud we can get you to squawk, Republican establishment, and we're going to do so with a guy that you really can't do much about. Because Donald Trump is independently funding his own campaign, Chuck. I mean, as far as I know, I mean, he may be taking some money, but he's not taking like major money from any of the big money donors. And it's tying the party up in knots.
Well, we've been talking about this now for months. This guy does not need the GOP establishment. That's been the whole issue all along. And he hasn't spent that much money.
Not really, because he's got, like I said, he's got a lot of people out there who really are, you know, this is their moment, Charles. I think it's really what you're seeing, folks, is, I want to say, the great recentering of the Republican Party.
Well, and this thing about not requiring GOP money, we haven't heard about... for instance, we have heard about Marco Rubio going into a closed-door meeting with Sheldon Adelson. We've heard about John Kasich going into a closed-door meeting with Sheldon Adelson. Who's Sheldon Adelson? Sheldon Adelson is a gambling magnate. Adelson essentially has enough money that he can go in. For instance, he wanted to have some influence on the campaign in Las Vegas and bought the local newspaper there so he could essentially control the editorial board. And look, this thing about, well, ownership does not have any influence at all on our editorial decisions. Don't kid yourself. If your job is writing on the line, whether or not you have an issue with something that the owner of the company is going to say, who are you going to go with? Obviously. You're going to go with the guy who owns the company. And if you don't, then you resign and go take another job. And in the newspaper business, those are kind of few and far between these days. That is a dying industry.
So are newspapers.
Yeah, exactly. It's a dinosaur industry. And, you know, everybody's going over to electronic publishing, which is another thing that has seriously tripped up the GOP establishment as well as the Democratic establishment.
That's true.
You've got insurgencies with guys like Bernie Sanders. Now, I don't know for sure if that's really an insurgency. I'll be quite honest. I think Bernie Sanders is a stalking horse. And by that, I mean his job is to make Hillary appear moderate. Now, how do you make someone like Hillary appear moderate? You put somebody so far to her left that he almost is over the, you know, horizon. And unfortunately, that's more of a perception than the actual reality, because Bernie Sanders isn't all that far to the left of Hillary Clinton. He just talks about, he's just open about his. He's honest. I'm a socialist. Mm-hmm. Hillary says, oh, no, I'm, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm this, I'm that. Bernie would be more in line. He would be openly communist rather than fascist, which is what Hillary is, economically speaking. I'm not saying he's a member of the Communist Party. Don't misconstrue me. Communism is communism is an economic and a social system, and that's more like where Bernie is. Fascism is an economic system wherein owners are given the illusion that they have some control over their own property and ownership, when in fact the government provides the capital, they provide the workers, they provide the markets. They provide everything for these owners, and it's supposed to create this partnership, public-private partnership idea. That's where Hillary is. And in that particular point, she's not all that far from most of the Republican field. That's part of the problem why people are revolting against the GOP establishment.
Right, and there are a number of other reasons as well, and we're going to talk about some of those today, because a couple of the other candidates are basically the poster children for these other issues that the GOP base find absolutely abhorrent. Everything from education to gun issues to life issues. If you want to find someone who's out of step with the base, you'll find them on that stage that they were on Thursday night. Now, Chuck, you know I mentioned a trio going up against Donald Trump's machine. And I say that because, although it's probably going to be certified and given complete validity this afternoon when he speaks at CPAC, which is the Conservative Political Action Conference that happens in Washington, D.C. every spring, Dr. Ben Carson has basically effectively dropped out of the race. And no, folks, this isn't a fake coming from one of the other campaigns spinning a yarn like supposedly happened during the Iowa caucuses. This is coming from Dr. Carson's own mouth that he sees no way forward to the nomination. And he's right. But the problem is, Chuck, there was no way forward for him to the nomination all the way back during the Iowa caucuses. His campaign has been filled with missteps. He's had core staff that have deserted the campaign and left him and gone over to Ted Cruz. He has had, numerous gaffes on the debate stage. Honestly, you know, he's kind of like Rick Perry making mistakes, but he just doesn't seem to understand that he's making mistakes, which is actually kind of frightening if you think about it.
Well, yeah, look, I don't know what Ben Carson's motivation was to get in the race in the first place.
He gave a pretty good prayer, folks, at the National Prayer Breakfast, and so doesn't that make him a presidential contender?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the way evangelicals think. Somebody comes up with a good prayer, and therefore they're a great presidential candidate. No.
Not so much. No.
Not so much.
And you know what, folks, for any of you out there who supported Dr. Carson, you probably had numerous reasons to support him, and that's okay, because he gave you numerous positions, sometimes on the same issue. I'm sorry, but Ben Carson is a fantastically brilliant neurosurgeon, okay? He is a fantastically brilliant practitioner of the medicinal arts. He is not a chief executive of the United States, never could be. Chuck, talk about political naivete. This campaign exemplified political naivete. Now, some will say, well, then you sound like the establishment because, oh, no, 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 no. The point is that you actually have to have at least some idea of what you're doing if the first office you ever run for in your life, Chuck, is President of the United States. Now, you know, of course, that gets me up on my soapbox because that's my big issue with many otherwise great people who decide they want to help out their country and fight back against darkness and fight back against the establishment, and they're going to run. But they're going to start running for president or the United States Senate or for Congress, and they haven't ever even gone to one of their local government meetings, whether it be the township trustees or city council or their county commissioners. Yes, folks, and those are all meetings that are open to the public and you can go to. And I would suggest that if you even have an itch of a hankering for possibly running for office someday, start out by going and getting yourself acclimated to how the governing system actually runs. Because, Chuck, as much as people want to talk about, you know, how the establishment's engineering all these things, when it gets right down to it, government operates based upon sets of rules. You know, surreptitiously, we run on the Constitution at the federal level, although, honestly, I don't see us doing that much anymore.
Right.
But we're still running under a set of rules. It's just that the rules are being made up as we go along. But that's not true for local governments, by and large. They have set times that they meet. They have to put an agenda. They have rules and regulations that are set and usually in our state, the local governments have things that are set by the state legislature of what they have to do, when they have to publish notices, what they can and can't hear, what they can and can't do if they go into executive session, how many times they have to hear something before they can vote on it. You know, those are all rules to help the process to be more open to the citizen. But Chuck, there's that lovely little second point of the whole thing, and that is the citizen has to be open to engaging in that system, in that governmental entity. You know, it's great to complain about your taxes going up and everything else, but if you're not there, you know, talking to your local government officials or voting for people after you find out exactly where they stand on the issues that are important to you. And Chuck, I don't know. If we took a general poll, and maybe our audience is a little bit different, and I'd like to think that they are, what percentage of people do you think, when they go to the polls in local elections, actually know the first thing other than name or who somebody's related to about the local candidates that they're voting into these local offices?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm going to post a scenario here for the sake of discussion. Now, what's interesting about this, as we've talked about, my wife and I are in the midst of moving. We are officially in our new house, and we no longer live in Westerville, although we still do own that house. And the thing about it is, Jenny didn't have time to change her voter registration. So I'm not sure how we're going to handle that, but I did, because I changed my driver's license because my birthday was last month. And my driver's license had expired or was ready to expire. So I ran in and changed all that. And when I changed the automobile registration, my voter registration automatically changed. Okay, so I'm voting for sure in Licking County. There's a hotly contested race here for prosecutor. I have no idea who to vote for prosecutor. I don't have a feel for it. And yet I know people who would go in and say, well, he's the Republican or he's the Democrat, so I'm going to vote for him or her. And the answer is, I'm not going to do that because I don't know who these guys are and I don't have time to find out. The election is what, the 15th?
Yeah, it's less than 2 weeks away.
Yeah. So,
As far as your wife goes, she can always vote a provisional ballot.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
And that's fine. I've even been talking, you know, I talked to my father the other day, who has had a number of health problems, and I'm like, hey, do you want me to get you an absentee ballot? He goes, I'm not even sure it's worth voting this year. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, right there is a big part of the problem. And not him, but the fact that you've got nobody is clear, and there's really nobody who's come up with any significant solid policy points during these debates where most of people get their information, especially on, you know, at the federal level. But, you know, at the local level, Chuck, you know, we're looking around here, and you know how big of a fan, and I'm saying this with sarcasm dripping from my tongue, you know how big of a fan of yard signs I am. But sometimes that's the only time you ever know that actually, A, somebody's running for a seat, or B, that seat is open locally.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's just, it's sad, but, you know, that's, where are we learning it at? We stopped teaching civics in the public school system a long time ago. As a matter of fact, Chuck, you and I worked for a number of years, and finally, about 2.5 years ago, we managed to get in place a piece of legislation that actually required schools to have to teach about the Constitution and the Declaration. because they had stopped doing it in the public school
system.
It
wasn't just that. It wasn't just the Declaration and the Constitution. It's some of the unknown documents, the Northwest Northwest Ordinance.
It was those things. And the Ohio Constitution.
And the Ohio Constitution. Now, I can tell you that law is roundly ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
absolutely, because there was really no... There was an enforcement mechanism in the original version of the bill that was introduced by Representative John Adams. But by the time that bill got done, it was a bill that was – the companion bill was being carried by Senator Larry Obhoff, and that bill had been watered down to the point where there really wasn't an enforcement mechanism against either the Department of Education or the local school districts if they chose to ignore these new standards or new laws that were being put in place to require them to set aside time to teach – basically what we used to teach in schools. Chuck, I took it when I was in high school. It's called civics.
Yeah, exactly.
How to be a good citizen. How to know the levels of government and the branches of government and how your local governments operate. We don't get that anymore. That's fallen on the dustbin of history, fallen in the dustbin of history, because we have to teach new things like Common Core math.
Well, the history that gets taught these days, they're so desperate to make it quote unquote interesting. I can remember the attempt when I was in high school, and remember I graduated from high school 41 years ago. I probably shouldn't admit that, but I graduated from high school 41 years ago. I can remember. I am a history lover. I am especially a lover of American history. And the way I can still remember, my book was so awful, so terribly bad, and they taught out of it because, you know, they'd spent all this money on the books, and this was the curriculum that was going to fix all everybody's dislike of history. They took somebody who loved history, and I dreaded going to that class. And I'll tell you why. You know how we studied history? We read letters. We read private letters between people. That had been archived someplace and all stuck in this book. We were going to learn about, not about the actual history, about the people who led us and the people who, and the events that happened. We were going to discuss the private thoughts of the people who lived in the era of those. Now, that can be a useful study at the graduate level. Mm-hmm. If you want to determine why people had certain attitudes and that kind of thing. I think that would be, and I have actually done those kinds of things. I have gone back and through and read private letters because I wanted to have a gauge of the attitude. And yes, I'm not a professional historian, and yet as an amateur, I understand that particular aspect of studying history. It's an important aspect, but not for kids who are like 17 years old. 16 and 17 years old, they don't care. Look, just give me the dates and the dead people and let me regurgitate it for a test, and hopefully I'll retain some of it. And maybe I'll have an interest later, and maybe I'll want to delve further. But no, they taught us this way. And I'll remember at the time my parents saying, you know what that's about? They're trying to basically turn you completely off of history.
Oh absolutely.
So... I happen to agree with that. Pardon my conspiratorial thinking on that particular thing. I think a lot of training in areas like history and government is done so that it becomes so boring or so irrelevant to what young people are interested in. That, and also there's a slight issue with, you know, young people are not interested in what's going on around them. They're taught to live in the moment by the culture.
Right.
And people who love history have learned that, no, living in the moment isn't it. We have to understand what's going on now, we have to kind of have a grasp on what went on in the past.
Sure, absolutely.
And we're actually taught, and I can remember taking classes in college where they ignore what happened in the past. This is now. This is an entirely different time. Well, anybody who's studied history knows that what's old is new again. There
right,
is
exactly.
The Bible very clearly, and I think it's in Proverbs, there's nothing new under the sun.
That's true. It's so incredible, Chuck. But you know what? We're looking at a point right here, and you know, and I mentioned some of the issues. And honestly, you know, you've got candidates out there who really... And this is the reason why I think a lot of voters get frustrated. A lot of voters think it doesn't matter. and a lot of voters stay away from the polls. You know, we used to say apathy wins most elections. Well, there's some truth to that, because when you've got candidates out there, let's just take our old friend John Kasich,
yeah,
who last night during the debate in Detroit, or excuse me, Lexington, really was just spot on, flat out reinventing himself. I don't think there's any other way of saying it. You know, he's totally reinventing himself, specifically as he was talking about education policy. Now, Chuck, you and I both know that in the state of Ohio, every governor that's come along in this state for the last 30 years has tried to make themselves the education governor, right?
Yeah.
George Voinovich did it. Bob Taft
right.
tried to do it. Ted Strickland wanted to be it. John Kasich's trying to do it. For some reason, they think that, you know, if we're seen as the champions of education, then, you know, that's our golden ticket to staying in office or moving up. Well, you know, here's John Kasich saying he's a believer in local education, school choice, vouchers, charter schools. And he may not be wrong with that, Chuck. But the problem is, he's also a big supporter of a federalized educational system centered around Common Core education standards. But in John Kasich's world, the federal government and the federal NGOs have nothing to do with this. This is all being driven locally, Chuck. How many local school districts are out there creating their own standards, Chuck? How many do you know of?
No, it's all coming down from, look, this is a top-down thing. Education standards are a top-down thing. Local districts don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Zero.
Right. Exactly. I'm going to take a quote from what he said, because, even beyond this, and of course, he's called folks who have stood against Common Core locally all kinds of names, okay? It's funny who Mr. I don't want to say anything bad about anybody, really will say a lot of things bad about people if they don't agree with him. But we'll get into that. But that's a sidebar issue. But
right.
Here's the real issue. I mean, he was asked by Megyn Kelly about, well, should the federal government bail out the Detroit schools? And his answer, and Chuck, I just want you to think about this for a second. Here's what he said. He says, this is not much different than what happened in Cleveland, Ohio, where the African-American Democrat mayor, the union, and business leaders came to see me and said, would you help us pass legislation to really create a CEO environment so that we can take control of the schools? We even invested in a buyout plan where we bought out the teachers who have been there a long time, because there were so many young teachers who had been laid off who were so enthusiastic to get back in the schools. It worked beautifully. Cleveland's coming back. The Cleveland schools are coming back because of a major overhaul.
I doubt it.
Well, okay, that's not even the part that brought me concern, because you know what? You can manipulate data all you want to, and when
sure.
you put a guy in the Department of Education who actually got caught manipulating data to make charter school outcomes look better than they did,
yeah,
and whose wife happens to be your presidential campaign manager, well, okay, you know, we'll give you a little bit of leeway on that one. But my problem was, Chuck, is here you had the locals, the mayor, the unions, and business leaders. Where was the local control? They came to the governor and said,
right.
Did you guys force the schools through legislation to be basically ceded to us? What is that a local solution, Chuck?
No, of course
it
isn't.
Is that local control, or
no.
Is that centralization of control? And honestly, Youngstown has gone through the same thing. And I mean, and it's been a complete, you know, train wreck where they've finagled some legislation so that the state could come in and basically take over Youngstown schools. Now, folks, if you think this is a great idea, yes, I know local schools, public schools, if they're failing in communities and there doesn't seem to be any hope for them, honestly, I think that the best option is allow competition into the model. It's not to centralize and have the state government and or the federal government change the rules and change the laws so that the state or a handful of a public-private partnership, because that's what we're talking about, Chuck.
That's exactly right.
When the mayor
right.
and business leaders come together, that's called a public-private partnership. And what they're basically saying is, we want control of the school systems. Well, where does that leave parents, Chuck? Where does that leave the local school board? Where does that leave the local control?
Well, it leaves it in the dust.
Leaves it in the dust. That's exactly.
I mean, you cannot look. Here's the problem, and we've talked about this on and off. Here's the problem with education. Nobody wants to pay the taxes so that, for instance, like the situation we're moving out of in Westerville, where the average teacher makes over something like $70,000 a year. You can't do that on taxes alone, at least the property taxes alone, because people would be essentially be bankrupt. So what do? You expect the state to come in, and what does the state do? Well, look, you're paying taxes on one end or another, but the fact is the state makes it look like they subsidize your property taxes for education by taking money that they've collected out of the income tax and distributing it to schools, and it looks more efficient. But the fact is, if you were taxed at the local level for your school rather than at the state level, you would have more control over the curriculum. You would have more control. Right now, school boards are essentially rubber stamps for state and federal policy. And in fact, that's their job right now is to, A, figure out a way to raise more money because they've got salaries to meet. That is by far the largest part of their budget. And don't let them kid you that it's not. Every time a local educational entity comes to you and says, we need a tax increase, what's it for? It immediately, it increases the revenue pool so that the union can come in and say, we need more of that revenue pool. So all the stuff that possibly you were promised this, that, and another program is going to disappear into the pockets of the teachers. Now, I'm not saying the teachers shouldn't be paid, but the fact is, when paying benefits for a teacher who works 6 hours a day, not 9 months a year, is in the $75,000. I think the teachers make in Westerville which we're moving away from. I think the highest paid teacher, and remember, these are public records, so this I'm not telling something out of school, was over $105,000 and I think in the $110,000 range a year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's absurd.
Yes.
Especially when we're getting the performance that we're getting out of this. Education is not getting better. It's getting worse. And the reason it's getting worse is because we're attempting to teach facts. And in some cases, you have to teach facts. For instance, in the history, like I talk about, you have to teach facts. But we're not teaching kids how to think. You know, that's the difference between a homeschool curriculum for the most part and a public school curriculum for the most part.
Mm-hmm,
and true. Again, this you're paying huge amounts of money into your system so you can find this out, that the reason it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because kids aren't taught to think. They're not taught to connect the dots. They're not taught to apply common sense and logic to a problem. They're taught facts. And again, like I say, facts are necessary, but very often there are things, for instance, you can't teach math by a fact method. You have to teach people how to think through a problem, and you have to teach people right. how to think through. And that's the problem. People aren't thinking through. And one of the reasons they're not thinking through is because you don't have local control of the school district. And you don't have local control of the school district because you don't have control of the purse strings. That was my entire point about that. Yes, I tangentialized a little bit. And what else do? I chase rabbits. And I chased the bunny a little bit. But the fact is, you don't have control of your local school district because you don't have control of the money. He who pays the piper calls the tune. That's the bottom line here. And everybody's in line for federal money. Well, federal money always has stuff attached that you don't want. So you have to decide. Now, I live just outside of a school district here that's exempt. And let me tell you something, the taxes are exorbitant. They wouldn't be that kind of thing wouldn't be so bad if they also didn't have to pay the state income tax. If all the taxation was local, everybody could say, well, we're paying the same amount as you, but it's all going into our schools and we control it. But that's not the case. You're paying the high property taxes plus you're paying the state income tax and the state taxes. That's the problem. That's what homeschoolers are squawking about. Why should I pay into the public system where I have absolutely no control over what actually is taught to my child when I'm at home doing it for a fraction of the per student cost? You know, I don't know what the per student cost in Ohio is at this point. It's got to be in the $5,000 or $6,000 a year range.
It's over the state share of instruction is over $6,000.
Yeah, it's what that's what I would have assumed. When I can, I know we homeschooled our kids through their high school years for about $400 a year, $400 to $600 for all three of them at once.
Exactly.
Okay, what's wrong with this picture? The picture is what's wrong with the picture is. Nobody has local control. Nobody has control over the costs. And the solution to everything is to raise taxes. Voila. You've lost control. You're essentially looked upon as a deep pocket and too stupid to do it yourself. When it's shown over and over and over again that homeschool families' kids perform better. Okay, well, we're not on an education kick here. We're on a control kick. Who sets the curriculum? And the answer is that the state does in part, but mostly it's done in compliance with federal education policy. There was no federal education department before, what, 1978? What got done about education before that? Well, you had some veterans loans. But as the education department came in, you get more and more and more and more takeover by the federal government of curriculum design and less and less and less responsibility to local taxpayers. So the education department, through laws that very often were well-intentioned, you know, the tyranny of good intentions, that essentially these policies are handed down by the federal government, the Department of Education, who says, you have to do it this way. And we'll cut off your money if you don't. Well, whose money do they cut off? Do they necessarily cut off the local? That's what Common Core, by the way, was all one of the squawks was. The money bypassed the state and went to the local. But let's go back to that. Normally what happens is the federal grants go to the state governments who then hand it out for people who are compliant with federal policy. That's how the federal government, that's how you centralize the processes like education. But education isn't out there by itself and the only thing being done that way. It's all public policy. And those are the kind of questions, Barry, that we should be asking guys in these presidential debates. And apparently John Kasich has decided that this is going to be his road. If, you know, the road, it continues to narrow for him, but his road, he apparently has decided, is going to be become the education governor and the education president.
Exactly.
And my gosh, who have we heard that from before? Who was going to be the George W. Bush was going to be the education president, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, yes. Many of them were going to be the education president.
So how's that worked out for us? How's education? Are you, you know, I'm going to ask the Ronald Reagan question. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?
Exactly.
And the answer is you're not. So what's wrong with this picture? Everything.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I thought it was interesting too, Chuck, and this is just kind of an interesting aside about that debate last night. Let me ponder this question to you. How mature and of a character is it when someone basically throws out as part of their discussion, well, people say I'm the only adult on the stage.
Oh,
That came out of John Kasich's mouth. And honestly, I had to laugh because, you know, when it really gets down to it, that's probably one of the more immature things to possibly say is to say, well, people think I'm more mature than you are.
this from the Prince of Light and Hope?
Yes, well, there's that, too.
This is the same guy who declared himself the Prince of Light and Hope. And I will ask again what I asked before. Is there any expanse of ego that this guy will not go to? I mean, seriously, how big can your ego get before everything bursts? And honestly, where I think it's going to burst is when he comes in third in Ohio.
He might actually come in second. I would hold my breath on third. But, you know, it's a possibility because the more he keeps coming out there and spinning it, the more that he could very well end up pushing himself to third place. The point is, though, that the high likelihood is that John Kasich is not going to win Ohio and that Marco Rubio is not going to win his home state of Florida. And as those are winner-take-all states now, Chuck, because they decided to go that route, that really spells all but the end of the campaigns for both Kasich and Rubio. Now, you see, during Super Tuesday, the other of that trio, Ted Cruz, won his home state of Texas, along with, I believe, what, two or three other states. He won Alaska, he won Oklahoma, and he won Texas. And that was actually a pretty solid showing, especially considering, Chuck, and I had to laugh about this one.
Yeah, he won a fourth state, and I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll have to go back and look at that. But in winning Alaska, what he basically did was he won the state that one of Donald Trump's earliest national adopting endorsers, Sarah Palin, should have delivered for Donald Trump, but she couldn't because, well, they're much more conservative. So I found it kind of humorous that, that the Palin endorsement of Trump did not help him deliver Alaska, and Ted Cruz took advantage of that.
Well, we've discussed that Palin endorsement of Trump, and you got to, okay, just real quick, that was a revenge move.
Oh, of course it was.
That was absolutely a revenge move. They have done nothing but savage her. When I say they, the GOP establishment took her on. McCain picked her for the simple reason that she had the support of the base. She was attractive. Mm-hmm. She's smart. She's governor of a state that it would guarantee that it would come into his. Into his camp, even though they don't have that. I mean, let's face it. I think they have three electoral votes, so maybe, I think three. Mm-hmm. That's not the point. She had the support of the GOP base, and he was lagging seriously. Listen, you and I sat in a meeting at the State House right after the election and talked about this. That election in 2008, and in 2000, and was that eight?
The McCain race.
The McCain, yes. We said I looked at people in the room and I said, I know why you all stepped up and came out for McCain after he picked Palin, because you were all thinking maybe McCain will pull a William Henry Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're not a history buff. William Henry Harrison died after 30 days in office. He caught pneumonia while at his inaugural by giving a speech in a sleet storm. He caught pneumonia and died. And his vice president immediately took office, who was John Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you guys were hoping, that something would happen. McCain would have to go and we'd have Sarah Palin. Well, a lot of people have changed their mind on Sarah Palin. I've been disappointed by a few things, but nonetheless, she's still a conservative. She's more of a populist. And of course that played into the endorsement as well, because she's a populist. Trump's a populist. Cruz is the only real constitutionalist in the field. So that played into it as well, because people were expecting that Palin was going to come out and endorse Cruz. Mm-hmm. That was the prevailing thought. And if he's the nominee, she's going to be right there with him. I'll guarantee you that. If Trump jumps ship and goes third party and any of that, she'll stick with Cruz or who honestly, that's not going to happen either. If Cruz were the front runner, he'd be getting the same nonsense that Trump is right now from the GOP establishment. In fact, they started fighting Cruz early, very early, assuming that he was going to be the guy who was going to carry that mantle. And that allowed Donald Trump, they left that flank open. And Donald Trump came in out of no place and basically said, well, I'm here and I'm running. Well, they haven't been able to stop the juggernaut since. And while they haven't stopped fighting Cruz, it's interesting to note that Trump and Cruz and Carson have teamed up to gather a huge percentage of the vote when the team up of the establishment guys, Rubio, Jeb, Christie, start naming them. Their performance has been exceedingly anemic, to say the least, anemic. So when you look, the GOP is pulling out all the stops. The GOP establishment is pulling out all the stops to try to throw Trump and Cruz under the bus, and they can't pull it off. In fact, the only real guy left in the race, and by the way, I did hear an interview between Sean Hannity. I tried to find a copy of it, and I can't find a copy of it. I was in my car. Basically, Hannity was interviewing Newt Gingrich, who Fred Thompson knocked out of the last election, if you'll recall. Fred Thompson came in order to keep Gingrich from getting any support. Thompson's job, he was a stalking horse, was basically to steal all Gingrich's support so that Gingrich wouldn't be the guy. But Gingrich showed his establishment credentials by coming out and saying that John Kasich was a great candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the way to try to steal some of the support away from Rubio and Trump and get it back over to Kasich to gin up some excitement about Kasich, which Kasich has not been able to gin up any excitement on his own. And it's four statements like you noted earlier, you know, the Prince of Light and Hope and that he's the only adult on the stage. Give me a break.
Yeah, those really don't meet the sniff test. Sorry. But, you know, again, I think inside of 2 weeks, the only thing that Kasich can hope for is going to be limping his way to Cleveland in July, hoping against hope that he can somehow make a case that he can help deliver a state that the presumptive nominee will have already won. And so I'm not seeing how it's going to be very helpful, and I'm not seeing honestly, I've seen a number of pundits talking about how they don't see a path for Marco Rubio anymore. I don't see a path for John Kasich anymore either. The question is at this point, though, Chuck, is that will Mitt Romney, who got out there yesterday and made such a stink about how horrible Donald Trump was, and he wasn't horrible when he was endorsing Mitt, but, now the shoe's on the other foot. Will he try to throw a wrench in the works by showing up at the convention and trying to become the great unifier? It's like, well, why don't you just endorse me at the convention? It doesn't matter what the voters have said. It doesn't matter who they've supported. As long as we get past that first ballot without anybody getting a majority, all bets are off, because that's how that works, Chuck.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking about brokering a convention. Brokering just means the horse trading that's going on behind the curtain and behind the scenes. After they take the first vote and find out that nobody comes up with that 1,271 delegates.
Well, 1,237.
Excuse me, you're right, 1,237. Okay, I'm having number trouble today, so pardon me, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, okay, here's what to look for at the convention. Look for a credentials committee fight.
Oh, yes. Oh, that. Well, that's what happened during the last convention with the Ron Paul supporters.
Exactly. If you come in with delegates, the GOP has ways of stealing them from you. You come out and say, well, this slate is contested. we're not going to seat these guys, because these guys and gals, because there's been a protest for over, you know, this, that, or another thing. And that, Barry, you and I have seen this at small party level.
Mm-hmm.
You get places where you've got a controversial vote coming up, and what happens? You start getting credential challenges. And what that means is you send a delegation, and the executive committee might sit there and say, well, they're not eligible to sit, or they haven't paid their state dues, or neither is most of the national committee.
They're not wearing their secret decoder ring.
That's so. It. Yeah. They don't have the tattoo on their right shoulder blade, you know. Who knows? But that's what you're going to see. All the stops will be pulled out. If Donald Trump has 1,237 delegates, all stops will be pulled in order to make sure that that first ballot does not nominate him. Because then all the pledges go away and all the deal-making can start. Because you're pledged to vote for your candidate on the first ballot.
Yes, you are. But after that, everybody's open. They become unencumbered delegates, and the horse trading can begin full apace at that point.
And it will. And you've already seen the maneuvering. I mean, this Mitt Romney is hoping that there's a deadlock convention, and they will pick him as a quote-unquote unifier. The guy who basically made the base sit home last time essentially will be the unifier. I don't understand, honestly, the thinking of the establishment. Well, we failed last time with him, but we can make it work this time.
Well, that's called basically whistling past the graveyard.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, I mean, Trump has basically called him, and he said, look, he had his chance. He's had it twice, and he's lost twice. Couldn't get the nomination the first time. The second time he got the nomination, and he couldn't, you know, He couldn't even make a decent showing of it.
Right.
What makes it look like he's going to do okay on this one? And the answer is nothing.
Not a thing. That's right. It's just, again, the lack of any kind of understanding of the core of the vote in your own party by those who are in the leadership of the party is phenomenal. It's just astounding that they can't seem to figure this out, and they don't understand that what they have been pushing and hoping people swallow is not palatable to the large core. Obviously, in many of these races, Chuck, 30, 40, 45, 49% of the base vote is going to a man who's basically saying business as usual stops today.
Well, there's another factor here that the GOP establishment is ignoring, and that is that GOP caucuses and primaries mm-hmm. are drawing more support than they have in decades. In other words, the number of voters is in cases four or five times what they are normally. For a primary, people are turning out to vote against the establishment. It's basically my point. That doesn't matter to them. What matters to them is the fact that we are losing control. It's not a matter of we want the party to win. We're losing control of the party, and you're beginning to see that the real impetus for doing all this is to maintain control, not win. And Barry, when have we seen that on a smaller scale in the state of Ohio in the past?
Refresh my memory.
Well, 2006.
Oh, yes, of course. Sorry, I was so deeply involved in that one, I kind of lost perspective.
Yeah, I mean, you and I talked about this on the show before. The fact is, in 2006, Ken Blackwell was the guy who ended up with the party nomination for governor. And what happened? People openly, in leadership of the party, went over and endorsed Ted Strickland. Well, how well did that work out? How well did that work out? Yeah, there was a backlash against the Republican Party in 2006, and it had a lot to do with George W. Bush, and it had a lot to do with a lot of things. Ken Blackwell was a great candidate. He had some things I wouldn't agree with him on, and he wanted to sell off the Turnpike, which I think, frankly, in light of things that have happened with, for instance, in Indiana that sold off its Turnpike, that would have been a disaster. But, you know, nobody's perfect. And Ken Blackwell was a great candidate. I still think Ken Blackwell's a great candidate. He's a clear thinker. I paid attention to his career when he was in Cincinnati. But what happened? Well, we elected this guy who basically played moderate and brought in a bunch of liberals, ultra liberals, and he lasted one term. And most and a few of the liberals he brought in didn't even last a single term. Some of them were forced to resign early.
Yes.
And some of them did what they normally do, and that's manipulate the electoral system, which was good actually for us because if you recall, we were third party at the time. And the third party voting rules were changed because it was perceived that they would hurt the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, hurt the Republican Party.
Yeah, no, right, exactly.
Even though it actually ended up hurting both parties because the Green Party came in and made it a splash, and the Constitution Party came in and also made a bit of a splash. So, this is interesting to watch, and you know, there's talk about people going over to the Constitution Party, well, if they can't do well in the Republican Party, and the Constitution Party says, well, everybody's welcome to come over here and make an attempt to get the nomination.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, our convention is in April.
Well, they'd have to, yeah, so basically they'd have to be double endorsed, but that could happen too, Chuck.
But the Constitution Party will have a presidential candidate that nobody will vote for by April. You know how that works.
Well, you know me, and again, I don't think this is affecting any of our listeners. As I saw some of that stuff coming out on that CP offer, I also noticed that that their spokesperson said that their party folks tend to put principle over politics.
Yes, tend to.
Which I thought was a more than stunning admission to what's happened to the Constitution.
Unfortunately, yes. I have a couple of the sweatshirts and T-shirts that say, you know, principle over politics.
Yeah.
And what I love to tell people is, been there, done that, got the T-shirt, now paint the house in the T-shirt.
That's right, because the T-shirt and what the actual party stands for aren't in line with each other anymore.
Yeah, I coat my driveway with the T-shirt on. Yeah, so
man.
You know, I this is a good discussion. Unfortunately, we're running out of time.
Well, I figured we might.
Yeah, you figured we would be, and I think we've kind of kicked it around a little bit. Now, what to watch? Watch in 2 weeks or 10 days. When the Ohio and Florida primaries happen, because those will put the nails in the coffin of several candidacies.
Most as a matter of fact, we may be down to a head-to-head by the time we get through March 15th.
I'm thinking, yeah, we'll be down to a two-man race. And that doesn't mean anything, ladies and gentlemen, because this will be the Republican Party establishment will be looking for a way to get one of their quote unquote unifier candidates. And I think honestly, it looks like what they would like to do is hand it back to Romney or hand it to, because let's face it, Rubio is self-destructed. He's going to need 4 years to reconstruct his image. And unfortunately, unfortunately for him, he's not running for the Senate again. He's already announced that he's not going to do it again. So what's he going to run from? What vantage point? And the answer is none. He won't have one. So his political career is probably at least on hiatus. Now, who else sits in the wings? We're almost out of time real quick. Who else do you see sitting in the wings in the Republican side who would act as the, quote, unifier that they would try to bring in?
As far for the establishment,
yeah.
I mean, you could run to just about any candidate. They may actually go back and ask a guy like Tim Pawlenty from Minnesota,
yeah,
who
possibly
had an aborted candidacy during the 2012 election.
I honestly don't know who they could go to. I mean, there's a lot of guys trying to line up to be it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe we'll think about that a little longer and it'll come up again. Okay. That's it for this week. You know what we think, but we don't know what you think, and we'd like to know. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And you can contact us there. And we would ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.